It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Under a new rule proposed by the Trump administration, healthcare providers who offer abortions would not be eligible to receive Title X funding. Title X does not and cannot fund abortions. Planned Parenthood cares for 41% of Title X patients nationwide. So what about here at home? Kimberly Everett is the CEO of Planned Parenthood of Western Pennsylvania, and she joins us in studio now. Kim, welcome to The Confluence.
Thank you for having me.
Kim, first off, what services does Planned Parenthood provide to the Pittsburgh region?
So we have a variety of services. We provide basic gynecological well woman care. We do sexually transmitted disease testing and treatment, breast cancer screening, cervical cancer screening. We also provide HIV testing. We have a new program, which is actually a mobile STD testing program where we go out into the community. And in May, we're going to be starting behavioral health services. So that's a new program for us to increase the needs of our patients. We also do pregnancy termination services. And lots of education in the community.
A lot of that sounds like a typical women's health clinic. What makes Planned Parenthood different, but also really necessary to the community?
Well, I think what's different about Planned Parenthood is we do provide services on a sliding fee scale, and many of our patients have low income. Actually, 60% of them have incomes at or below 150% of the poverty level, and so they receive free services. That's one piece of it. We also go out into many other communities. So we're in Cambria County and Somerset County, where we're the only Title X provider.
And Title X, that's part of the funding piece that makes those sliding scales possible.
Yes. Yeah. Title X is a family planning program that's been around actually since 1970. And it was established to provide birth control and reproductive health care services, excluding abortion, to people with low incomes. And we've been part of that program since then.
What has that experience been like from your perspective, being so involved in Planned Parenthood for so many years, seeing that evolution and also these waves of political change throughout the years?
You know, Planned Parenthood's been around a long time, actually since 1930, and even back then we were controversial. So it's an organization that has been at the forefront of really pushing social norms. So this is kind of the culture of Planned Parenthood. But what I've seen over my tenure has been a lot of change just in the healthcare environment. So we've gone from a time when people had very little access to any kind of covered services for gynecological care. Title X was pretty much it. And now health insurance covers it, and we've seen that progress even through the ACA, where it's a part now of every insurance plan that you have well woman care. But still, there remains a population that doesn't have access, doesn't have insurance, is underinsured, and depends on these services through Title X, which is now at great risk.
What is your role as the leader of, as you said, this 80-year-old organization that seems like for most of its tenure has been under a threat of closure or challenges to its funding, protests, or even just the run-of-the-mill political pressure?
So I have many roles at Planned Parenthood. We all wear many hats. It's probably more political than most nonprofit CEOs have to be because of all the legislation and things happening in that regard. But, you know, it's the usual. It's the finance. It's making sure our programs get rolled out, strategic planning, and making sure we're providing the services to the community that are needed. It is more difficult when you have things like a gag rule that threatens to take away your funding. But we have a wonderful board, wonderful staff, and many supporters in the community that help to make that happen. And of course, fundraising is a big piece of what we do.
Have you seen the tides change at all in the years that you've been working with the organization?
You know, what I've seen is, I love to tell this story, since Title X was approved, back in 1972, there was actually a stamp, a postal stamp for family planning services because it was so popular and people were so supportive. And I think what we've seen is the country become more divided over this issue, and that makes it more difficult to provide services. So if anything, I've seen more of a division. But overall, family planning is more accepted, more people use contraceptive. Almost everybody uses contraception at some point. And even abortion access is more accepted now than it was years ago.
It seems like Planned Parenthood nationally became a lot more political under its former national president, Cecile Richards. Did her advocacy or her leadership model affect the Western Pennsylvania branch at all?
I think it affected the whole country. It was actually in 1992, I believe, that the first action fund nationally was started. Mm-hmm. And that was because we were seeing politically more attacks against Planned Parenthood, against abortion access, against family planning services. And so Cecile Richards didn't necessarily bring that to Planned Parenthood, but she was someone who was able to move that forward and really help the organization articulate its issues and its concern. And it's not really about Planned Parenthood, it's about the women that we serve. And she was very good about addressing the needs of the people that we serve in this country.
How important do you feel it is as the local CEO of a branch to wade into some of those political discussions?
Well, it's really critical because here in Pennsylvania, we have not always had a supportive administration. House, Senate, all the way up to governor are very important. And what happens is when you don't have that support, you get more barriers to providing care, you get less money. And actually, for many years, we saw defund Planned Parenthood legislation at the state level, similar to what we're seeing now at the federal level. So it does make a big difference. And in my role, I have to be political.
Do you ever feel like you spend so much time having to defend the organization rather than just getting to focus on the services that you offer?
That can be very frustrating. Sometimes I feel like we take one step forward and five steps backward. But I think over time, what we've seen is a growing awareness of the important work that Planned Parenthood does. Definitely after the 2016 election, we saw a huge outpouring of support for the organization, and that is continuing.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris talking to Kimberly Everett, CEO of Planned Parenthood of Western Pennsylvania. Kim, you mentioned the election. After Donald Trump was elected in 2016, Planned Parenthood nationally and locally reported a massive surge in volunteerism. I remember here locally, it was hundreds more people applying to work as patient escorts in the health centers, education departments. You need people willing to help, right? That's
great. Absolutely.
Great
it's
to
wonderful.
Have that spirit of volunteerism.
Yes.
But what was it like for you as an organization to take in that many people to do security checks and make sure that they wanted to be there for the right reasons?
Yeah, it was a lot. And, you know, I have to say that it was very hard for the first few months and probably didn't do as good of a job as we would have liked to because there were just so many people who wanted to be part of the organization. But, you know, we found jobs for people. We continue to get a lot of people and we continue to work to find things that they can do and ways they can help.
How many volunteers are still working with you today?
We still have several hundred volunteers. At one point, we were probably up to 1,000 people who, you know, were actively wanting to be engaged, and that was hard. But we always have rallies. And now, again, with this Title X issue, we will be doing different rallies and grassroots organizing. And so there is a place for people who want to be involved.
Is that an interesting juxtaposition for you? You always need help and volunteerism, but often most of the attention comes when you're under duress. There's a challenge to be faced.
Yes, it is interesting. But we do our best, you know, even in times when it's quiet, which isn't very often. You know, I think what's been pretty constant for us is since that election, there's been a steady threat for us. And now, of course, May 3rd is our date that we may lose our Title X funding. And so it's very real right now.
What are you learning? What are you hearing from your patients and from other providers about the Title X struggle?
From our patients, not quite as much. You know, we try to educate them about it when they're in the office. We try to get the word out. But I think because of all the things happening nationally, there hasn't been as much coverage about this particular regulation. A little bit more now that things are moving, but we're trying to educate people and make them aware of it. But for those, when they learn about it, it's a huge concern.
Does it feel dire from your perspective?
It does. You know, we've faced so many challenges in the past. You know, we have our motto, our doors stay open. We are working to fundraise. There are legal strategies that are being deployed. And so we know we'll still be there to educate our patients and to provide services to them. But I think at a bigger level, it's frightening when the government thinks that it can come in and tell your medical providers what they can and can't say, and to tell them that they can't give people options or try to dictate the medical care that's being provided. So, you know, we have counseling staff, we work with people so that we follow the laws, but we also give people the choice that they want and let them make the choice.
what would this do to your other myriad services, the counseling components, the outreach that you do in the community? How would losing Title X potentially affect everything else that you do?
Well, we, of course, will not take the money and we will not compromise our services and provide unethical care. The biggest challenge for us will be just finding money to replace the lost dollars. It would be about $400,000 a year, and we will work to do that so that we will not have to change any of the services that we provide, and that we'll also be able to meet the needs of the people in our community.
And speaking of our community, here in Pittsburgh, of course, women have many options for medical care. How would this affect rural areas?
It will be most challenging in the rural areas. For example, in Johnstown and Somerset, we are the only provider of Title X services, and people depend on us. And so if we are not providing those services, no one is. And so we're very committed to making sure that those people have access to care.
Planned Parenthood, of course, helms other projects. There's a 24-hour texting hotline for curious teens, violence prevention training, preventative treatment for folks who are maybe at a higher risk of contracting HIV. How are those and other offerings affected by this ongoing and repeated political battle?
Our education services are funded either through private grants or through donations. And so despite the politics going on, these are important programs and they will continue, and the funding for those programs is solid.
What challenges do you think Planned Parenthood would be trying to tackle if, as an organization, you weren't always so busy defending yourself?
Yeah, we have we always have a lot of plans and things that we want to do. And those plans are about expanding our services, reaching out to more communities. Things like our mobile testing program has been very successful because there are people who just don't have access. We would be rolling out our behavioral health services to more locations. So just kind of an expansion of what we currently do, and spending more time really focusing on what the needs are and how we can meet those needs in the community.
Do you ever just get to brainstorm?
We do get to brainstorm. You know, and sometimes it's strange. We recently had a meeting where you're sitting there talking about all these things that you're going to do and how you're going to do them without really focusing on the fact that you could be losing funding and your core services are at risk. But I think you just have to work that way. You have to plan for what you know needs to be done and then figure out ways to get there. And if you have a step backward because of a funding issue, you just figure out a way around it.
Kimberly Everett is the CEO of Planned Parenthood of Western Pennsylvania. Kim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. This year marks the first NCAA tournament where Pennsylvanians can legally bet on games. And Rivers Casino officials in Pittsburgh say bets have been nonstop. One organization even estimates that 1 in 5 Pennsylvanians will make a bracket or place a bet. And state lawmakers this week voted overwhelmingly to make it harder for officials and government employees convicted of crimes related to their jobs to retain their public pensions. It would also forfeit pensions at the time a defendant pleads guilty or no contest, or is found guilty by a judge or jury. Find more at our website at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris. Male, female, or non-binary? The question of gender identity has been drawing more attention, and it's a key theme in Luxury Blue Lace, the debut collection by Pittsburgh-based poet Sam Korfman. The 28-year-old Korfman tells 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll that the collection began during a graduate workshop at the University of Pittsburgh.
I was researching kind of the media obsession with trans kids, and what I realized was that what I was trying to do was sort of revisit this space of my own childhood where it was not quite clear what gender-wise I wanted, and it was not clear to anyone else sort of how to respond, per se, in the early 90s.
So let's talk about this excerpt. Do you want to set this up?
So this one shows up early on without a title, as a kind of, I don't know, tender, direct address to myself as a child, and the kind of moment at which I gave up a kind of pleasure, a kind of dream of one sort of variable future, and understood, began to understand that certain forms. In the poem, I call them shapes, and so form becomes a stand-in for like a life, like different kinds of shapes. Little daughter, what did you know when you felt a nameable pressure, drew shapes instead of people, faces that became blue triangles, red squares. Today, I tried to draw those shapes again, arbitrary circles, and with each attempt thought, how, when I cannot even study a line?
Talk about those shapes a little bit. What do they a little bit more represent to
you? Yeah. So I drew a lot of figures and faces as a kid. And I was usually drawing in like pastel colors, and I was usually drawing mostly girls. And so there was a certain point, and I usually pinpoint it at around 8, at which I sort of gave up my Little Mermaid lunchbox, and I stopped doing quite as much expressive drawing in that particular way. But what I did become really interested in was like abstraction, which is maybe, I don't know that anybody quite put that together until I sort of was like, oh, that was the pivot.
And I know that it's a fraught enterprise with poets, especially to assume that the I in the poem is an autobiographical I, but it seems like there is a lot of autobiography in this book.
These poems, pretty much the I is, I think, always me, which doesn't mean that the I is always me now or consistent throughout the book, per se. Big question of the book is, like, how many I's live in the same speaker over time?
There's a line that says, it's from The Crisis 2, I guess this is, when the therapist guesses my sexual role as if such a thing were certain, it's not important whether she was right, I think, even though she was. And it made me think about how people define their sexuality or their gender and whether they need to.
There's the formulation in which gender sort of precedes sexuality, and then there's the formulation in which our gender is primarily defined by sexuality. And I don't really sort of buy that either way, sort of. The other anxiety of the book maybe is having to define yourself, right? Having to be put in a position in which you have to then say, this is the role, right? And so one of the things about that line that you read about, it's not important whether she was right, even though she was, is the sense that like, okay, like, but maybe it will change. Maybe, you know, what do we sort of lock ourselves into by saying this is true now without having a shared understanding that it might not be true later?
I saw you got a review in Publishers Weekly.
I did, yes.
That's pretty great.
That is pretty great. That was the first moment that I had of like a stranger reading the book. One of my anxieties and difficulties writing the book was all about how much complexity can you give to a reader, and really trusting that I could give this kind of what felt to me sort of like immensely complex and indeterminate space of gender formation to a reader. And that review, I was like, oh, great. Like, you got it. So that was really wonderful.
That was 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll speaking with poet Sam Korfmann, whose book Luxury Blue Lace was published by Pittsburgh-based Autumn House Press. I'm Megan Harris. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, in for Kevin Gavin. The City of Pittsburgh and Urban Redevelopment Authority are holding their fourth annual Inclusive Innovation Summit downtown next Thursday through Saturday. The summit will feature two full days of speakers, presentations, and conversations designed to increase awareness and knowledge of inclusion and encourage innovation that benefits the whole Pittsburgh community. Joining us in studio are a few panelists and organizers. Jennifer Wilhelm is the Assistant Director of the URA's Center for Innovation and Entrepreneurship. Welcome, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Todd Smith is a summit organizer and community digital specialist with the city's Department of Innovation. Thanks for coming, Todd.
Happy to be here.
Betty Cruz is the co-founder of Change Agency, which helps create partnerships between officials and folks implementing programs on the ground. So glad to have you back, Betty.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And Claire Drobot is the director of new play development at City Theater, which creates space by and for diverse audiences. Claire, welcome to The Confluence.
Thanks so much. Excited to be here.
Let's start off to all of you. For so many of us, the word innovation is used a lot. It's often a moniker for fancy new technology. What does innovation mean to all of you? Todd, let's start here.
Sure. To me, innovation is more of a mindset. And I think that is really kind of the seed behind this event and the work that we do between the URA and the City of Pittsburgh and the organizations like Change Agency and City Theater. And I think it's just an approach to solving difficult problems, which sometimes we face right now with accelerated technology, and coming together collectively as a community to solve them together.
Jennifer?
To me, it's really also about evolution, how communities are changing. You need to continue to innovate. And for us, that means really bringing people together to solve problems, as Todd said. I think we don't want to evolve just to evolve. We want the city to evolve in a direction that's going to be inclusive for everyone and make everyone feel welcome living here.
Betty, what about you?
To me, the most innovative solutions are oftentimes, it seems, the most simple ones that are like staring you in the face, and how to bridge that and how to do it in an intentional way. And really just kind of step outside of yourself and get a fresh perspective so that you can see things clearly, which is what I think a summit like this can do.
And Claire?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's about building new collaborations and kind of thinking from a theater perspective. It really is about telling new stories and how you can kind of reflect back the world around us and use it, you know, for change and specifically for good, too.
When you're thinking about a big event like this, but also just the work that you do every day, is innovation limited to just big ideas? How do you implement it on the ground?
So it doesn't have to be just big ideas. I think, as Betty said, it's sometimes staring you right in your face. So we do a lot of work with the accessibility community, who has been very helpful in helping us design an inclusive, welcoming space. So to that effect, simple things about like digital accessibility, so when you're sending an email to make sure that your pictures have alternative text, these are simple solutions that make a big difference. So,
anyone else?
Yeah,
I mean, I think that idea of the big and the small, I mean, sometimes it can be something as simple as ensuring that all of your videos are captioned, or that you're looking at intentionality when you're reaching audiences, so that you're really truly trying to create programming that reflects the city around you.
And I think to get there, it's about exposure. It's about constantly looking for a curiosity, I guess is what I would say. So being curious and having those conversations, building those relationships, looking and learning to see what other places are doing, other people right in our backyard, but in other spaces. A lot of the times the things that we're doing that might be perceived as innovative by others are just borrowed and adapted.
I also new to Pittsburgh.
Yeah.
It's also really important to work with the audience that you're trying to communicate with. You have to, instead of assuming that what you're providing them is appropriate, we really need to have that dialogue and conversations. So, for example, we've had a lot of meetups and groups where we've talked to different communities throughout Pittsburgh to talk about how can we best communicate with them, how can we best engage with them. And so this summit is really a culmination of a lot of that as well.
Are there any successes that you're just especially proud of? Examples, things that worked out so much better than maybe you thought they would?
Well, I'll say there are a few things. So I would say in this case, in this year, transportation is something that we've really changed this year. So mm-hmm. We have free transportation to get to the summit. That's not something that we tackled in previous years, but we brought together all the different partners. We realized that this was something that we could handle and everyone got really excited about. So it's not a programmatic thing, but it's something that's going to allow people to show up and engage in ways they maybe couldn't afford to do before.
And there's childcare as well, right?
There is also free childcare and free food.
What steps do you feel like are being taken, not just to connect with elected or business or even community leaders, but regular citizens as well, that collaboration aspect?
I mean, I think this city is known for its nonprofit sector and the foundations that support that. And I think they're reaching residents in ways that we really need to connect them not only to city government or city services, but connecting each other to this work that's happening around Pittsburgh that's dedicated to thinking intentionally about inclusion and innovation.
I think the way the call also went out, the fact that it was really this wide-reaching call for Pittsburgh to step up and present whatever concepts they want to see showcased at the summit, I was thankful to hear from different partners who were really excited and like, what can we do? How can we celebrate this work that a lot of times we're quietly doing behind the scenes mm-hmm. and give it a stage to share that and come together? So,
thinking of that stage, this is the fourth annual event. What have you learned from previous events? You know, are there new panels, anything like that?
I'll let Jennifer start because she's been here since the beginning, to be honest.
The event has evolved incredibly over the years. What we've really seen change is the broadening of what inclusivity means across the programming. So I think in the beginning, it was much more about traditional issues of race and inclusion from that mindset. But now we've broadened it beyond that as well. So we still focus on those issues, but we're also looking at disability and youth and seniors and access to digital technologies. And so it's really broadened because what we realized is that there needs to be more voices at the table.
Jennifer, I'll put you on the spot again. What do you think you're most excited about for next week's panels?
So one of the kind of topic areas I'm really excited about this year is mental health. We're bringing that in, which isn't something that you always see in these types of events. And we're going to have a World Cafe where there's a lot of things going on. It's going to be a dozen or so different exhibits happening. We're going to have free coffee all day so people have a way to engage, get their tea or coffee, and also to see what's going on in the community. Because to Betty's point, one of the things that we're trying to do here is just create a platform to elevate and make people aware of the great work that's already happening across the city.
Previous summits were longer, spread out into different communities, different neighborhoods. Condensing this year's event into one place, do you think that that will change the level of inclusion? Jennifer, you're nodding too.
Yeah, I definitely, this was a difficult decision for our team, but we also took a lot of feedback from our partners that really drive us to do the work we do and guide our way. It was just difficult to have over 60 events across the city of Pittsburgh and have people show up at all those events. The original idea was to spread equity. That's what partners asked us to do. But as we grew as a team and as a network, things about mental health and accessibility issues are hard to manage when you have that many programs. And a lot of the organizations actually were responsible for the space and the marketing. So taking that off their back so they could focus on the programmatic part means our team can be more centralized in managing inclusion.
And we were talking about this morning, but the response has been really wonderful. It's exciting to know how many people have registered and that you are going to have all of these disparate organizations that are going to be together in one space. You can actually forge some of those connections and forge some of those new collaborations that will lead to future innovation.
Yeah. And if you sign up on our registration form before the 26th, we'll actually send you a complimentary bus pass. So we're really doing everything possible to make up for the difference of not having events across Pittsburgh, but our evening events. You didn't ask me what my favorite events are.
You gotta jump in.
True that. Our evening events are really exciting. And so we're hosting our kickoff at the Kelly Strayhorn, which is just such an important organization and to the culture of East Liberty. And so we're having a great event there and with the Pittsburgh Tech Council, Chula. And we got Backstage Capital, which is an internationally renowned inclusive venture capital firm that's going to come and speak about their process for investing in underserved co-founders, founders. And then on Saturday night is the All-In Silent Disco, and this is the second year this is returning. And my last thing is Andre Perry, who's from Wilkinsburg, is delivering the keynote midday on Friday, and so you won't want to miss that.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Megan Harris, and we're talking about making innovation and inclusivity more available through a summit. So we've talked a little bit about moving the events to the downtown area, and you're offering free childcare and bus passes. I'm curious, what are your goals overall for the gathering?
So that's a good question. The vision of a summit is that you reach a peak. But we don't see that being a final destination. It's almost kind of like our birthday as a team. We come together and celebrate the accomplishments and the work that we've done over the past year and the work that still is necessary for the future. So there's been always great examples where the work continues. Just a quick one, Thrival last year, which is a local event that happens in the fall that focuses on music and innovation. They worked with the disability community, to build an accessibility stage at Thrival this year. And they only learned about that when they were involved with the All-In Silent Disco last year. So those cross-sector partnerships come through during the summit, but they really materialize still after the summit finishes.
I also think one of the big goals this year is to empower people and inspire people who are there to take what they learn outside of the summit. So take it back to your place of employment. Take it back to your neighborhood. We need more people on the ground who are learning things through the programming and then spreading that knowledge.
To all of that, I'd say, yeah, what are the threads that help us all better connect dots on our day-to-day work? So I'm thinking about how I saw Jennifer at our All for All. All for All is our immigrant inclusion initiative, and we had that last our summit last year. And how can we thread? So that's a great. That's one thing that happens. Then there's Thrival that happens. Then there's other types of convenings that are happening, including this important one that's in many ways the big kickoff of the year in terms of looking at inclusivity in our region. How can we? I'd love to see how this helps us further connect and accelerate the individual ways we're all working around inclusion and carry it forward year round.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely that idea of, you know, we often live in these silos that, you know, the arts community is in one sector, you know, you're working with technology, but we don't actually get to cross-pollinate a lot. So having a point that brings everyone together and then the ability to take that and use it as a launching pad to collaborate throughout the year is really key. And I don't think there are a lot of cities that are doing this in this way.
And cross-pollination is the innovative DNA behind all this work, too.
Claire, I'm curious, your job as the new play development with City Theater requires so much collaboration with arts and production groups in the city. What are you hoping that this event brings specifically to that arts community in the city?
Sure. You know, I think one of the jobs of new play development, and I'm specifically a dramaturg, which is this weird word that no one actually knows what it means. In doing that, part of what you're looking at is not just how we're putting together the art on stage and how you're working with a playwright to develop a script, but how we're actually working with our community to support performances. So in being able to connect to wider communities through an initiative called City Connects, which is a program that we created that takes engaged partnerships and connects the arts and advocacy world, it allows us to form new partnerships and actually bring new people into the theater and then support the mission of organizations like All for All, One Hood Media, Casa San Jose. We also have representatives from all three of those organizations on the panel we're doing. So it's really special to be able to share these new collaborations and the work we're doing and support organizations with shared values in the city.
Betty, so much of change agencies' mantra seems to be building collaborations, networking, building partnerships like that. What do you think is missing in the city of Pittsburgh right now in terms of that connectivity from people on the ground doing the work to those in leadership and power who could maybe broaden their abilities?
So I think I would just go back to using our partnership as an example. I think that in some spaces you'll find a lot of talk around the need for more inclusivity, equity, and folks that are saying it and kind of throwing their arms up in the air. What do I do? How do I do this? And I think legitimately some people, it's a struggle, right? It is a process. It's not a one and done. It has to be something that you're working at every day in order to actually achieve it. It's not a marketing campaign. And I think that with what I've seen with Claire and City Theater is that they not only say that they've wanted to do this, but it's reflected in how they approach the relationship. So actually building meaningful relationships, not just showing up when you need something, but showing up to like authentically want to understand the communities you're talking about and you're wanting to work with, and then having that reflected in your day-to-day work. So even if so in addition to having the relationships that we have, in addition to City Theater hosting the talk back that we hosted together after Citizens Market, where we had representatives from the immigrant community share their stories, really compelling young woman who shared her story as an undocumented immigrant, for example. That was in direct connection to that play that brought to life the experience of immigrants. So you see it on the stage, you're there interacting with the arts in that way, but then you're also seeing the reflection in how the community is built in.
To each of you, we're running a little low on time.
Sure.
Is the annual summit enough of a check to make sure that this work continues to happen throughout the year? You know, how do you ensure a check on these organizations to make sure that the movement keeps going all year long?
Well, we have other convenings that happen actually throughout the year.
The meetups, right?
Yeah, we have monthly meetups around different subtopic areas all around inclusivity, and we bring together different partners around those topics. And so we're always continuing to build new partnerships and have those conversations and try to really look towards outcomes. And I think that we're getting there for sure.
And just to add to that, the meetups was actually an idea that partners gave us after the second Inclusive Innovation Week, who said, why can't it be Inclusive Innovation Month or Day? And so the meetup has been a great way to continue the work throughout the year.
And I think it's also, there's some impetus on the organizations involved so that all of these partners carry on these, and it's reflected in your core values. So I think it's something that, you know, the entire team at City Theatre is so excited about the work All For All is doing. You know, we're getting to host an event of theirs as part of Remake Learning Days, so you continue those connections, and the impetus is on you as an organization. And I think that's really exciting to be able to kind of set that challenge to everyone who's involved in the summit.
Is there a challenge? Is there a call to action at the end of the summit? How do people set goals, and how do people stay in touch throughout the rest of the year?
That's a good question. So I think definitely connecting with us online through our meetup is a great way to continue the work. We got something in store for the final event for a takeaway for people to, you know, keep this in mind and fresh after they leave the summit. And I think we're still figuring that out, just to be honest. It's an evolution process. But I think the work will continue.
I think intentionality and authenticity is important. And if you actually, like, when you walk away from an opportunity like this, there is a certain burden of responsibility that's on us to then show up, because there's really, really great things that are happening in our region. We talked about Kelly Strayhorn. We've talked about City Theatre. There's lots of great programming that's happening. But you have to want to pay attention and show up. So show up to the summit and then keep showing up every day.
Claire?
Yeah, I mean, I think the challenge is exactly that, is to continue to build on the work and know that this is, that innovation is an ongoing process. It's never going to be finished. And if you want Pittsburgh to be a welcoming city, there's a way in which you have to continue that work and be dedicated to it.
Jennifer, final thought?
I would say if you want more information on the Inclusive Innovation Summit, or just generally the work the city is doing around this topic area, we do have a website, weinnovatepgh.net. You can find all the information there.
Thank you all so much. Claire Drobot works with the City Theatre here on the South Side. Betty Cruz is co-founder of the Change Agency. The URA's Jennifer Wilhelm and the City of Pittsburgh's Todd Smith are organizers of the Inclusive Innovation Summit that kicks off next Thursday. Thanks so much to all of you.
Thank you.
You can find links to their work, their offices, and the summit itself on our website at WESA.fm. And for today, that is The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. Next time, City of Asylum Pittsburgh creates a thriving community for writers, readers, and neighbors. We'll talk to the new executive director. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Mick Stinelli, Noah Brode, Julia Zankovich, and Alex Lenigan. I am the editor and producer of The Confluence. Kevin Gavin will be back with you on Monday. Until next time, hope you have a good weekend of good news.